Blog Talk Radio.
This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas on Monday, March the 13th. As we like to do on Mondays, we'll be chatting with our good friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. There's a lot on our plate today, as you would expect, a bank collapse in the Bay Area. Apparently there's another one, but I'm not 100% sure about that. There's a problem on the border. There's a problem with Mexico, China in the Middle East. Some journalists went before the House, and they ran into some skeptical Democrats. And then, of course, it seems like an eternity ago, but only last week, President Biden proposed his budget. So a lot to get into. Let me say hello to our friend Bill Katz. Bill, welcome to the week where nothing happens.
Oh, nothing happens. Nothing happens. Now, one thing we ought to make sure to do, Silvio, this bank collapse, without any question, was caused by global warming. I immediately knew as soon as it happened, this was global warming. After all, this was a Silicon Valley bank. They're having terrible weather problems out there. You've got to understand this is a result of the internal combustion engine and global warming, and I don't think any further discussion is necessary.
No, I think so. I think we should put that one to bed because I think you hit it out of the park. You hit that one out of the park. It's all about global warming. What else could it be?
Yes.
What else could it be? But it is interesting. And here's the part that I find, and not specifically on this problem, but it seems like every other problem facing this administration, the president will come out, he'll read a statement, and then he walks away. And he won't even answer a question. Now, I know that other presidents have done that before, but they usually do it when they speak from the Oval Office. That's what that is for. But if you're going to go in front of the reporters, you should at least have an expert with you who could answer some of those questions. I don't expect the president to be an expert on banking failures, but he could have had the Secretary of Treasury or somebody and say, look, you know, the Secretary will answer some of your more specific questions, so ask him or ask her. That's the part that always bothers me about this president, Bill.
Well, that is the problem, and what is so frustrating about it is he has at his right hand probably the most experienced and wise advisor any president could have, Kamala Harris. I think that, you know, if he would just turn and say, Cammy, solve this, it would be solved.
Right.
And, you know, the only thing that I've heard from my friends in Washington is that sometimes she's at the beauty parlor, but other than that, she's there. She can solve it.
Well, she would take out her diagrams, you know, and she would take out her diagrams and tell us how they will do it. Now, again, I don't mean to make fun of a serious problem. A bank is a serious problem. It looks like the administration will protect depositors. That's probably to avoid any further, you know, delay or any further decay, I guess, in the situation. But a lot of people are not happy about that, Bill, because this is a bank, from what I'm reading, this is the bank that apparently was more focused on climate change and on LGBTQ issues than actually running a bank, Bill.
Well, that is the problem. I mean, it's like the articles we're beginning to read about the American military, that they're more focused on being woke under the direction of the employees and appointees of this administration than they are in winning a war. And this is what happens when politics begins to dominate everything. And everything, you remember the slogan from the 1960s, the personal is political? I'm afraid some people take that seriously, where everything is politics and there's nothing left for anything else.
Right. No, that's it. That's exactly right. You know, I was thinking earlier today that how much we miss Charles Krauthammer on a day like this.
Oh, yes.
It so happens that he was born on this day in 1950, would have been 73 today. We lost him at a very young age. Unfortunately, but he was such a wise man. And days like this, you know, I would always look forward to his commentary at the Fox Report. And it's never been the same since he left. That much, I'll tell you, Charles Krauthammer. But there's so many things going on, Bill. I want to begin with something that you wrote a few days ago about China in the Middle East. Apparently, China has now decided to become a broker in the Middle East, and that, of course, should make the United States very proud, Bill.
I guess there are people in Washington who are proud. I mean, after all, the administration of Barack Obama invited Russia back into the Middle East, and they had not been a power there for decades, and all of a sudden, Russia was all over the Middle East. I guess they were proud of that. I guess they're proud of the fact that China negotiated a deal between Saudi Arabia and Iran, a deal that ordinarily we would have been negotiating, and we were completely pushed out of it. I guess they're proud of that. And it also benefits Iran, and there are certainly some people in the Obama in the Biden administration, well, the same thing, from the Obama administration who want to help Iran in any way they can. They kind of think it's all just a big misunderstanding. But what is so striking about this is that this was negotiated by a country with no history in the Middle East, China, and now probably the strongest country in the world. And there's so little concern expressed in the press. I mean, as if this is just, well, you know, who really cares who negotiates it? I mean, they go to Staples, they get some paper, they write, and that's basically the attitude. But this is a disaster for the United States because it symbolizes our weakness, and it also symbolizes the fact that I think is growing in image, and that is we can't be depended on. And that's one of the worst things a country can have attached to it is that label.
That's right. Well, especially a superpower. I mean, when you're the superpower, you're supposed to be relied on. And speaking of China, not only are they back in the Middle East, they're pretty active in Latin America. I mean, they're talking to Latin countries about military bases. And, I mean, it's just amazing. I thought we had something called the Monroe Doctrine. I guess that must have maybe that's no longer politically correct. That's probably what happened to the Monroe Doctrine. It's no longer politically correct. But there was a time, with or without the Monroe Doctrine, there was a time when countries would respect, you know, something like, you know, somebody else's neighborhood. They would say, no, we're not going to mess around. That's the American neighborhood. We're not going to mess around there. But China seems to have forgotten all about that, Bill, and they're out there. And many of these Latin American countries like Brazil and Argentina and Chile, who are now currently in Colombia, who are now run by left-center politicians, I mean, they're more than happy to sit down with China because China is providing them a lot of money as well as everything else. So, you know, this is something, for me, I worry about it because I don't see anything good that can happen from China. Becoming more involved in Latin America. After all, they do have a lot of mineral resources, and they are in our neighborhood, Bill.
Absolutely, and I was just reading an article in one of the press services that now it is indisputable that China has become the major naval power in the world. Their navy is larger than that of the United States Navy, and in fleets, the amount of ships do matter. They seem to be building every day where we're concentrating on teaching our armed forces about wokeness and about how terrible a country we are. China is gaining everywhere. That doesn't mean they're perfect. That doesn't mean their economy is perfect. They have problems, as experts like Gordon Chang have pointed out. But they are in a remarkably strong position. And one of the reasons is that when they want something, we just stand aside and let them have it. And I think one of the things that the press will not talk about too much and must talk about is the fact that many big American corporations are compromised by their relationship with China, which is a financial relationship.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, that is the difference, that we didn't have that kind of or American companies didn't have that kind of relationship with the Soviet Union. I mean, Union, you didn't have American companies producing and manufacturing in the old Soviet Union. But here you do have many American and Western companies very much involved in China. And like you say, it does create a unique relationship, because all of a sudden, you know, it's almost like a lot of these companies are saying, hey, you got to protect China because that's where I manufacture my stuff. That is a big difference between right now and the way it was with the Soviet Union, Bill.
Absolutely. I mean, we did have in the 1930s and even during World War II, sadly, some surreptitious relationships between American corporations and the Nazis. That is one of the unfortunate parts of our history. It has not been discussed too much, but the information is out there. But during the Cold War, American corporations had very little in common with the Soviet Union. I probably think that they would have taken some business if they could get it. But for the most part, they were on our side. And with the end of the Cold War, I think many people thought, well, you know, the world will now be safe and everything will be okay. It's not okay. China is a totalitarian nation. Its leaders hate the United States, and most important, they hate the American system of government, and they are growing more and more powerful. And you can see by this deal between Saudi Arabia and Iran that they get results. They're very results-oriented. And yes, now they're in the Middle East to stay. They're in South Asia to stay. And I think if some of the stories I've read are true, and I think they are, they're in America to stay. They are buying up thousands of acres of American farmland. I have no idea what they intend to do with it, but it is not a very good situation for us. They overfly us with intelligence balloons, and we make jokes about them. I don't think it's funny. I really don't.
Yeah. Bill, where do they get all this money? That's the other, you know, you see them everywhere, and everywhere they go, they're very liquid. They've got a lot of money. Where do they get it? I mean, I know they have a big economy, but it just amazes me how you know, where they get all the money to buy all this farmland and all of these, you know, all of these arrangements that they make around the world. I mean, where's that money coming from, Bill? I mean, maybe it's a stupid question, but I kind of like to know how they're making all that money, Bill.
Well, they have become manufacturers, and Apple sells an awful lot of computers around the world. And that's where it's coming from. It's coming from the profits made in business with the United States and with other large nations. I mean, do they engage in illegal and illicit activities? Yes, according to our government, and I see no reason to dispute this. They steal intellectual property, which means they steal the way things are made, blueprints. They steal literary material. They are a rogue nation, but because of the relationships they have economically with the United States and with major American industrialists, that level of corruption that they maintain is kind of overlooked or kept quiet.
Yeah. Well, but this is, I think, the point we were making before about this economic relationship with the United States. I mean, we're in bed together with them in a way. I mean, many of our corporations need China tremendously in a way they never needed the Soviet Union. So I think that's another factor that comes into play.
Yes.
I mean, I think it was Senator Manchin who was on TV in the last couple of days saying that, why are we going to let, I think it was the Ford Motor Company, build electric batteries in China? Why are we letting that? Why don't we build them here? And, you know, that's the kind of thing. You know, these companies are going to China. They're not just, and they're going to China for some reason, I guess, maybe cost of labor. I don't know why, but, you know, why would Ford Motor Company want to build a factory in China? I mean, we could use that here, Bill.
Absolutely. Well, it's Ford. I mean, now I understand from today's news that members of Congress want to take action against Ford. for some of its business dealings with China that they feel are hurting the national defense of the United States. I don't know if Ford cares much about the national defense. The history of Henry Ford I was not a good one in terms of his attitudes and some of his ideas. But, money talks, and you can be sure that a percentage of every business deal that is made on a large scale with China, that a percentage of it goes to the Democratic Party in one form or another, either in campaign contributions or some other kind of help. These people know how to operate. They really do.
Well, something else, too, that when you open a manufacturing operation in China, you're not in business with private shareholders in China. It's not like, you're in business with Chinese. You're in business with the Chinese government. So they're participating in all these profits, the Chinese government. And
yes,
the Chinese, and so, I mean, it is really, it's a very corrupt situation. Because if you went to Mexico, and you built a hotel, you would be in business with Mexican hotel investors. You wouldn't be in business with the government. But in China, just as is the case in Cuba, and I would assume another, North Korea, the same thing, if anybody wants to invest there, you're going into business with the government. So, yeah, you can do all you want because you're protected by the government, Bill, who not only protects you from this point of market share, but also protects you by guaranteeing you cheap labor, which is, I assume, another big attraction of China, Bill.
Yes, and it's not only cheap labor, it's forced labor.
Yes.
I mean, they don't have any difficulty getting people to man these plants. And let's face it, American consumers have looked away. I can't deny being one of them. My computer says made in China, and we kind of look away. Other products now, by the way, you'll notice are being made in Vietnam, and that is a completely dictatorial country. Money talks. If people can save some money, they will go there. And China has tremendous advantages in this. And the only advantage we have is governmental action to break up some of these relationships, and that may not be very popular with the American business community. This is a tough problem.
It really is. Now, let me get back to the economy for a second here, Bill. You wrote an article last week about consumers and credit cards and how more and more Americans are using their credit cards, not their debit cards, but their credit cards, to actually pay for the essentials. And you got to sit there wondering, how long can that last? We talked a little bit about this last month or last time, but you published this information after we spoke, and I read it a little bit more about it. This is really scary because this is the one side of the economy that we don't see. On one hand, we see job creation, and on the other hand, we see good macroeconomic numbers. But then when you go inside the numbers, that's when you really begin to see people using credit cards, insurance going up, home insurance going up, car insurance going up. Yes, people are working, but they're not necessarily able to beat the inflation with the money that they're making. So there's a lot of bad signs underneath this economy. I don't want to be pessimistic, but I am worried about just how healthy this economy is, Bill.
Well, I think that the word fragile is coming into use. It's a fragile economy, and one bad jolt can destroy public confidence. We don't think enough about the importance of confidence of the people in the government, confidence in the banking system. Confidence is everything. If people lose confidence in a sector of the economy, we could have a national economic tragedy. We had runs on banks in the early 1930s, and that was stopped by Roosevelt's bank holiday. But you could have all kinds of things happening. You could have freezing. I saw a TV story last week about people in the real estate industry getting out of the real estate industry because they can't make any money. And that's not something you usually hear about real estate. But in many parts of the country, things are very badly frozen, and there is great, great uncertainty about their economic future.
Yeah, that's what it is, uncertainty, and I think fragile is exactly right, very fragile economic situation. Two big stories, Bill, that I want to talk to you about this week besides everything else that is happening, as you probably know, because you follow this stuff, we have a difficult situation on the border with Mexico. Some Americans were visiting, and they were killed, allegedly by some cartels, and this provoked the senator from South Carolina, Lindsey Graham, who represents these people who were killed at the border. These four people, well, two were killed. One was injured, and the other one's okay, I guess. And he said that it's time to maybe look into naming these cartels as terrorist organizations.
Yes.
Unfortunately, that was picked up by the president of Mexico as if Lindsey Graham was suggesting that we should send troops into Mexico. And he reacted, I guess, like any other president would, you know, talking about sovereignty and all that kind of stuff. And then he really did something stupid. He said, well, maybe we should have a boycott or get Mexican-Americans or Mexicans in the United States to boycott the Republican Party. And that, of course, was reacted by Republicans up here. But it sure looks to me like we have a problem in Mexico. I see it down here for a lot of reasons, not just because I'm close to it, but because I'm very familiar and interested in Mexico. Do you see it up there as well, Bill? I mean, do you see this problem on the border and this concern that many of us down here have?
Oh, absolutely. It's part of a multiple series of concerns. You know, it's never just one thing. It's one thing that may make the headlines one day, but under that thing is something else. Now, if you take a look at the border situation, the rushing of the border, the infiltration into this country of gangs and cartels, that's one problem. But under that problem is the ineffectiveness of the President of the United States to do his job. I mean, that's got to be discussed at the same time. Now, one of the interesting things in recent weeks is that some Democrats have stepped forward to challenge the administration on the immigration. Now, they're doing it to save their own careers because they see, obviously, through polling, what's happening in their own congressional districts. But under the border situation is the president. Under the president is the weakness of Congress. Congress is basically deadlocked. Each party controls one house. And then encompassing it all is another problem which deserves a lot more discussion, and you're not getting it because there's a self-interest involved, but the inability of the press to cover these stories accurately and completely. We have a journalism in America today that is practically asleep.
Yes. Well, I think the point you make about President Biden's border policy to me is the most important, because that, I think, is the inability to have a border policy that I think has made the border so easy for people to go through. These cartels are moving drugs into the United States. They're moving people in the United States. This was not happening to this level under President Trump. And that's because I think President Trump had a policy on the border that he meant for the government. I mean, he said, look, this is our border and we're going to respect it. But you mentioned the media. I also think there's another problem, Bill, in all of this. And remember that article I sent you that I wrote at The American Thinker? I think there's two problems here that nobody in the media wants to talk about, or at least I don't hear it. Maybe they talk about it somewhere, or maybe they talk about it in places that I don't follow, but I don't see it. Number one, we have a consumption problem in the United States that is very serious. And
absolutely,
every one of these drugs, every one of these dollars that goes back to Mexico for the sale of drugs, somebody's making that purchase, and that purchase is being made here. So we have to address our consumption problem. How we do that, you know, you remember First Lady Nancy Reagan had that program years ago. Yes.
Just say no.
And just say no, and maybe we got to do something like that again. Maybe we need more education at the kids level. I mean, at the school level. I mean, I don't know what we need. Maybe we got to get more parents involved. I know here in the Dallas area, we've had a couple of young people die from it, and the school boards have been very active talking about this. But we do have a consumption problem, and nobody talks about that, Bill. I mean, am I the only one who is saying that, Bill?
You're not the only one who's saying it. It's said all the time, but nothing is being done about it. I mean, they could solve this fentanyl crisis not easily, but with greater effectiveness if they really cared. But you have a government in Washington and a press that covers them that really probably has some highly intellectualized view of immigration, that what do borders really mean in the modern world? They have as much right. After all, Texas used to be part of Mexico. They have a right to be here. We have to help them, and the police are the bad guys. And when you begin with that premise, when you begin with the premise that the American victory in the Cold War was to be regretted, and some of these people on the fringe left believe that, you're not going to get very much wise policy.
Yeah. Well, it's very unfortunate because in this particular issue, I think the local media is actually doing a much better job.
Oh, much
better.
If
you watch the local media here in Texas, they are very, I mean, just about every night in the local coverage, there's a story about, the consumption problem. And you have reporters going out to the high schools and talking to the parents. So I think the local media is talking about it, but the national media, for whatever reason, just doesn't seem to care that much about it. At least that's the impression I have, Bill. I very rarely see a discussion of drug use in any of the national newscasts. I see it locally, and the local press, yes, they do talk about it, but I don't see it in the national level, Bill. Maybe you do, but I don't.
The national level of journalism in America sees only politics as a crisis. I mean, again, this is what they were taught. It is the kind of education we're giving to kids today, that everything is political and everything can be traced to politics. They don't see the human side. They don't seem really to care that much. There have been a few stories I've seen on the national level about the number of fentanyl deaths, but very, very few. And they are, I just don't think there's any doubt about it, that the national press is very much wedded to the Democratic Party. Now, that's something that really first-class journalists did so much work on to prevent. The Joseph Pulitzer tradition, which was the new tradition in journalism, was that you separate your editorial page from your news pages and you report the news without fear or favor. And the press was going along pretty well for a while, but then the 60s mentality came along and all that favored it. And now what we have is a national press that sees itself not as reporting the news, but making the news and shaping the news.
Right. Making a difference. They want to make a difference. They want the world to look one way or another. Bill, let me take a little break. We've got a lot more to talk about with our friend Bill Katz right after this. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, chatting with our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. You know, Bill, I was looking at On This Day in History yesterday, and it was the anniversary of the very first fireside chat by President Roosevelt. Wouldn't that be a fantastic way for President Biden, or any president really, to talk to the American people and the parents about drug use? By using fireside chats and talking to the country about the dangers. Maybe this president is not the one who can do it, but some president, I mean, to me, the fireside chat was such an effective way of communicating with the American people because you went directly into their neighborhood, and I guess nowadays it would be their iPhone, but still you're talking about the problem and they're listening to you, Bill.
Yes. Well, President Roosevelt's fireside chats were history-making, and you have to really set the stage as to when they occurred. They occurred as the Depression was really hitting hard in the United States, and the medium of radio was beginning to grow up. This was long before television. The first fireside chat, I believe, was in early 1933 when the president was inaugurated. And no president had ever spoken to the American people that way before, basically saying, beginning his speeches, "My friends." In fact, I have a book that I'm looking at right at my bookshelf right now, which is a book of his speeches, and it is called My Friends. American presidents would give formal speeches. There was a distance, and he, in effect, took you into his confidence. And the first fireside chat, if I recall correctly, was about banking and about the problems with banking. Isn't that interesting? What are we talking about this week here in America? And he spoke man to man. The chats were very effective. It's been pointed out that you could, when the president was on, you could walk down a street in America. Most people didn't have air conditioning, and so windows were open. And you could hear the entire speech or the entire chat just by walking down the street because every radio was on. Americans
right.
looked forward to them. Eleanor yeah. Roosevelt also, by the way, had a radio program, but it was a new way of talking to people, and it had its effect because people felt that the president cared about them, that he understood their problems because he would always discuss how people lived, how they acted, what we're trying to change. Very, very effective. Can this president do it? I don't know. I don't know if he has it in him. But we have to restore the notion that the United States government actually understands what's happening in its own country, and that will be, once again, a role that, in which the press will be very, very important. And I don't know if today's journalism can do it. You know, we think we're a connected country because of all the wires around. But in many respects, we're not a connected country because the national conversations are so short and so distant. You know, many people talk about that. They say, you know, everyone says we're connected. I'm not connected to my family, these people will say. They're in California. And you know, without – in 1933, most families in America were within a block of each other. For goodness
That's
sake,
right.
where I came from in New York, in Brooklyn, our whole family was along Ocean Parkway, the cousins, the nieces, and you could literally walk it. But the spreading out of this country has made it harder to communicate. I think that your idea is an excellent one, that the president should sit down and talk to the American people. He should do it regularly. The press conferences mm-hmm. are useless because the questions are usually useless. But that was one of Reagan's great strengths. He knew how to talk to Americans. He knew how to talk to Americans. Yeah, go ahead.
You're right. No, you're exactly right. By the way, just a historical fact, it was 90 years ago yesterday, 1933. So exactly 90 years ago today, yesterday, that the first fireside chat. But I see it as such an effective way. Obviously, it wouldn't be on the radio because kids don't listen to the radio anymore, but there could be other ways of communicating. But my whole point is, whether it's fireside chat, whatever medium, there has to be a conversation about the consumption and the dangers of it, because we're killing a lot of young people. I mean, as I said, we just had three young people not far from where I live who were killed by the consumption of these
yes.
pills. So this is very,
you know,
very dangerous. Very dangerous.
You're absolutely correct. You know, what you could have is a day. Most schools have public address systems, and there can be a link to an outside radio in case of emergencies. You could have a day where the president speaks only to the kids of America.
Yeah,
during the school day, and said, "Kids, I just want to talk to you about what we're doing in Washington and why it affects you." And I remember something that they tried in the 1950s, and I'm a little vague on this, but some schools, at least some schools in the area where I lived, would invite celebrities mm-hmm. to come to the school before the senior prom. And they would come and they would meet the kids and they would talk to the kids about car safety, which was a big issue in those days because we had senior proms in which there was a lot of tragedy. You know, at the end of the night, two or three kids from a school could be dead. And so they tried to do it that way. But anything that helps would be useful. But we have to have among our political leaders a far more effective way of communicating with people. Now, one person who is out there and who does know how to communicate with people is Ron DeSantis. He's
right.
Very effective when he speaks to people, and one of the reasons is exactly the reason that Roosevelt was effective. He actually knows the issues. He is
mm-hmm.
very knowledgeable about the issues. You can tell his speeches are not written for him, and he's not just given a briefing. He feels those issues, and I think it's doing him a lot of good. And another one I have to say, as much as he is controversial, is that Donald Trump knows how to talk to people when he wants
right.
to. When he speaks to workers, he speaks from the viewpoint of a man who has hired thousands and thousands of people. He knows their problems. He knows what the process is like. And I think that's one of the reasons he won the election in 2016. He got so many votes in the Midwest from workers who were being hurt by the current policies of the administration.
Absolutely. And he knows how to talk to workers about things like health insurance because he was in his companies. He created the programs. You know, he was aware of the programs that these workers had, you know, because he was the one signing off on them. He was the one that had to agree to them. So, yes, but I just feel that, you know, you talked about celebrities. Think of the great role that some of these football players and baseball players and basketball players and soccer players, think of the great role they could have talking to these young people about these things instead of, you know, painting the field with all these social justice garbage. You know, talk about drug consumption and how
absolutely
this is such a. I mean, these are people who are making millions of dollars, and I don't fault them for that. I think it's great that they can make that kind of money. I think it's great. If I had their skills, I'd make it too. But they have such a responsibility, it seems to me, to talk to these kids because the kids do listen to them. I mean, I remember when my kids were playing, they would idolize these athletes. And if you told one of my sons that, let's say, Nolan Ryan was going to be on a channel today talking to kids, they would all join in to listen, Bill.
Oh, absolutely. Now, as long as we can keep Colin Kaepernick out of it.
Right. Who's now blaming his parents, I understand.
Isn't that something? He's blaming his parents.
Isn't that amazing? Amazing.
Just what a selfish, self-centered man. And it's disgraceful. I would say you do the same with movie stars, but I'm not mm-hmm. so sure we really have any movie stars any longer.
No.
We have people who are temporarily famous. And when I was growing up, we had real movie stars. They were stars for more than 2 weeks. Isn't that amazing?
Right. That's right.
But,
well, now, I mean, judging by the audience they had last night for whatever they – what were they doing? Like, they had some kind of an awards program, right, I think, last night?
The Oscars, yes.
Oh, the Oscars. And did anybody watch it? I don't know. I didn't watch it.
I don't know. I
don't think the audience was that big.
Well, I'd never heard of most of the movies anyway.
Well, why? How can you have famous movie stars if nobody knows about the movie? I mean, when you back then, if you said Jimmy Stewart, at least somebody knew what movie he was in.
Somebody knew
or
the whole
Marilyn Monroe or whatever. But these people, I don't know any of these movies either, Bill.
No, they seem to come and go, and most of them fail. The feature film industry is dying anyway. Even Steven Spielberg
yes.
says that. And the film that was the most successful, I think, in history, was nominated for an Oscar last night, and that was a Maverick, Top Gun Maverick, and was completely ignored because it didn't apparently deal with social themes and social justice and being different and capitalism and its discontents. The film industry forgot its audience, and the audience forgot the film industry.
Right, That's why nobody watched
it.
How are you going to watch? You know, if you're going to watch, I remember when I was reading something yesterday that this is going to be the 40th anniversary of that movie, The Sting. You know, when that movie came out.
Oh yeah, sure.
And how that movie? I mean, that movie had a lot of success. It was a great movie. I loved it. But, you know, when that movie was up for the awards, I was actually interested in wondering if it would win anything. It actually did win a lot of things. But
yes.
That's because I had seen the movie, And I liked the movie, so I was interested in seeing what happened to a movie that I actually enjoyed. But as I said, I have no idea what movies are up. I don't know. I don't watch any of them. So I would rather watch something else or do something else, Bill.
Well, that's it. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when the Oscars really were star-studded.
I
mean, you look out over that audience and there was just one movie star and everybody knew them. Everybody knew who they are. Everyone had seen pictures of them in swimsuits. People would point out. Today they look at the audience and you see a bunch of people that you've never seen before who are going to be stars for a week. We used to have a radio program called Queen for a Day. And I get the feeling that the people who designed Queen for a Day designed the modern motion picture industry. And, I do have a screener from the Writers Guild of the movie that won the Oscar. We will watch it now that it's won the Oscar. I do have at least a little bit of curiosity. But we had films with real stories, with casts that were great and great writing. There's been such a decline, and ironically, it was in the early 1970s that films started to be made and television programs about the history of Hollywood as nostalgia films, like the film That's Entertainment. It was a nostalgia film, and that was 50 years ago. We're 50
right.
years ahead, further, and the situation has gotten much worse. Spielberg said recently that the feature film industry is basically dead, although he did give Tom Cruise credit for reviving it financially because Top Gun made so much money. But the habit of going to the movies was part of the American scene. 90 million people in 1 year went to the movies every week. And I remember the movie theaters would put out little pamphlets of coming attractions so you got to know what was coming up at that theater. And the theater was a place you visited. It was part of your life. Today, going
right.
to the movies, first of all, I'm not paying $5 for a box of popcorn. That's for
right,
sure.
Right, right. That's for sure. No, you're right. It's getting as expensive as going to a sporting event. But the one thing I will tell you about going to the movies for a long time, that was your favorite Saturday night date. You know, you go to a movie and then go out for dinner. I mean, that was one of the favorite ways of you know, getting to know some girl that, you know, you wanted to go on a date with. You take her to a movie, and there were so many choices of movies that
That's
it was
right.
actually a lot of fun. One thing I wanted to say about the border bill, getting back to that, and then I want to talk about these two journalists at the House meeting, at the U.S. House meeting. Yesterday, there were like 1,000 people that rushed into the border. And they had to be stopped, and it got pretty ugly. But that's exactly, I mean, that those are the kinds of scenes that we're watching now, where people are rushing into your border, and that just doesn't look good at all for the Biden administration. And the other thing too regarding Mexico, what worries me about Mexico is that these cartels are becoming so powerful; they have so much money, so many weapons, that they could actually become a threat to the Mexican government. They're not there yet.
Yes.
They're not there yet.
Yeah.
They're not, I mean, it's not there yet. But it is, you know, in many of the outlying communities and, you know, many of the small towns, that's where their presence is more powerful. And, you know, there's a story that you hear out of Mexico all the time that, you know, the police chief gets a phone call at 9 o'clock at night saying, hey, tonight at midnight, there's a bunch of trucks going by your town. You know what you got to do. Well,
yes.
That means you either let them through or we know where your wife is and
That's right.
we're going to kill her tomorrow. So that's what's happening in many small towns in Mexico. It's not happening everywhere, but it's happening in small towns that all this money in the hands of these cartels is corrupting the Mexican judicial system, and that's not healthy for that country, Bill.
No, it isn't. That country should be much more productive, but that is what happens when laws break down. And we are certainly not helping Mexico by our attitudes. We really are.
No, you're exactly right. The border, this presidency has done more to harm, or to help the cartels, I should say, than any any president that I can think of. I mean, even Obama had more decency or more common sense than this president. I mean, it's just amazing to me. But I guess that's what happens, Bill, when you run the border to please the immigration activists rather than to run the border for what it is, which is the border of your country, Bill.
That's right, and you have a right to keep people out if you wish. That is our sovereign right. And it's we look ahead to the fact that next year we're going to be electing a president. Didn't we just have an election? They seem to be coming more and more frequently. Actually, what's more and more frequent is the campaigns. Campaigns for president now last years. I mean, in Britain, the campaign for a national office lasts 60 days. And in this country, we begin them in the last generation. I mean, I know that they were already campaigning in a maternity ward in one of the hospitals here.
Right.
The babies were campaigning. And they're already starting out. It's going to be a very, very bruising year politically. I think we know that. I don't think we have the wisdom as a nation in our leaders and in our press to deal with it effectively. One of the things we talk about the role of the public, and the word crisis is much overused in American life and in American journalism. But if we have a crisis in this country, it's a maturity crisis. We are in many respects a very, very immature country, which is not the country I grew up in. They had gone through the Depression and World War II. These were grown-ups who knew that things can get very serious for them. Today, I mean, we have a television media which really is based on quick reports. You know, I remember the days when television news was just coming in and starting to replace newspapers, and somebody quipped that the more journalists work in television, the shorter the books by journalists become. It was a reflection of what television was. Television, and I heard the complaints from journalists. He said it's a pretty boy medium. Well, it wasn't a pretty boy medium. There are some serious TV journalists, but the depth of the work is not very good. The knowledge, the body of knowledge that many journalists have seems very, very small. Compared to many of the journalists I knew when I worked at the New York Times who really knew their stuff. And I think we are paying a price every day for that failure.
Absolutely. No, I think you're right. And in fact, that kind of leads us to our next topic. I don't know if you had a chance to see, Bill, these two reporters who spoke at a House meeting, House session, I guess, whatever the word is, oversight hearing. And it had to do with the use of, I guess, Twitter and other other social media, and the relationships that they had with government offices or government agencies. And I thought these two reporters were pretty good in how they answered those questions. I didn't see the whole thing; it was a very long, but I saw enough clips to get the gist of it. And I thought the Democrats who were asking them questions, Bill, were just absolutely awful. This lady from Texas, from Houston, this lady from Houston, who, by the way, she was one of the impeachment managers. Sylvia Garcia is her name. And she's a congresswoman from Houston who, never really came across as a crazy person, but she clearly came across as a very ignorant person the other day in the House. And the questions she was asking, like, is somebody paying you to be here? You know, did Twitter pay you to be here? When did Mr. Musk give you this information? And the journalist is saying, well, those are called sources. You know, we don't reveal them. I just thought that in one hand, Bill, it was so comical. But on the other hand, it was so sad. And I think somebody like you, getting back to what you just said about serious journalists, I'm surprised that the media didn't jump all over those Democrats for how they treated serious journalists, Bill.
Well, the media is asleep half the time. The Democrats on the committee didn't understand the purpose of a free press. They were abusive in their behavior. There was also that congresswoman from the Virgin Islands who was it the Virgin Islands or one of those territories?
No, it is.
We
this
have
is
around.
The funny. Forgive me for interrupting you, but this is hilarious. She is the ranking member on that committee, and she's representing a territory. So she's not even a district. I mean, she's not. I mean, the last time I checked, the Virgin Islands was a territory. I'm not saying they shouldn't be represented, but I didn't know they were a member of Congress, Bill.
That's a very good point that you bring up. I do know that there are members of Congress from territories. There is a member of Congress from the District of Columbia. I don't know if they're permitted to vote. I don't know anything about it. I'll look that up after we go off the air. But
remember, the representative from D.C., they do get electoral votes.
In the presidential election.
And I do believe she is a member of Congress. Maybe not. Maybe I'm wrong. But my whole point is that, you know, the idea that you would have as a ranking member a person from the Virgin Islands, somehow I had to crack up when I heard that. Not because there's anything wrong with the Virgin Islands. I just didn't know they were a district in the Senate and the House. But anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt you. What were you going to say?
I wasn't saying anything. That was okay. What you said. The whole idea of territories is going to come up again because they're trying to make now, as you know, Puerto Rico a new state. And also that they're trying to make the District of Columbia a new state. Now, that's a real problem because the District of Columbia was set out as a federal city, not to have the same status as other federal cities. I mean, I think they have a congressperson who can't vote. I don't know what it is. But making the district a state may require a constitutional amendment. I think a lot of scholars believe it would.
Right.
And I don't think the votes are there. Making Puerto Rico a state could easily often be a problem because the Puerto Ricans don't pay income taxes now. And if they were a state, they'd have to pay income taxes. And they may not want that.
Well, every time they put it up for a vote, they reject it. I mean, Puerto Rico has very often voted on this, and they prefer maintaining their current status, which is what they call an associated state or something like that. So the Puerto Ricans have rejected this every time they put it up for a referendum. Now that may change, but of course we know why they want to do it, Bill. They think they're going to get two senators out of it. That's the reason that they want to do it. I mean, I don't think they're very interested in Puerto Rico.
No, I don't. I haven't seen any deep interest in Puerto Rico or the Virgin Islands. I've never heard the Virgin Islands mentioned. I don't think people know where the Virgin Islands are.
Well, I know where they are, but I didn't know that they had a ranking member in a very important committee in the House. But I guess you learn something new every day. But I thought it was so funny that hearing. That, you know, they're asking these two guys, who did you vote for? Well, I voted for Biden. Who did you ask? I mean, these are two liberal journalists who had the decency to step up and say, we don't like what we see. And the Democrats in the House committee were eating them up, just beating them up, Bill.
Yes. Oh, yes. So look, these hearings have become farcical. They're all basically television events. People want to get their 2 minutes on television. But I think the Democrats really have begun to run scared also. I think they see what's happening. I see that their entire party now really depends on Joe Biden running again.
Right.
If Joe Biden decided not to run, the party would come apart. I mean, it would be chaos.
Because
the second in command is a, quote, woman of color. Let's put it right out on the table. And how do you say no to her? How do you say no to her and expect to live the next day? And she's less popular than the president is. They really have problems.
They really have problems.
I think the most important person in America today is Joe Biden's doctor.
That's right. Well, all kinds of jokes that they're going to keep they're going to keep him going as bad as it gets.
Yes.
They're going to keep him going. Well, Bill, as always, thank you so much for your time, and thank you so much for joining us. Good news, Bill, is that the baseball season starts in 2 weeks. So
that's great.
That's great news. So we can look forward to that. Well, as always, thank you for your time, and we'll see you again next week.
Looking forward to it, Sylvia.
Bye-bye. Our good friend, Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda, talking a little politics today. Have a wonderful day, everybody.